Today is July 25th, 2018, and we have a special broadcast on wearable and health technologies tonight. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question a little differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on wbai.org/archive. Also on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5, New York on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are different. Tonight, WBAI is on a membership drive. Tonight, we're devoting the entire evening to health technology, and I'm going to have Dr. Alfred Poor interview Dr. Nick, and it's going to be quite interesting. Take it away, Alfred.
Welcome. This is Alfred Poor from Health Tech Insider, and tonight on the Personal Computer Show, you're in for a real treat. I've got a show for you tonight that's all about digital health. And rather than sit and tell you all about what I know, I've got somebody who really knows the whole business. He's a good friend of mine and a colleague, and his name is Nick Vanderhaeden, but popularly known as Dr. Nick. He's a doctor and is currently the CEO and founder of incrementalhealthcare.com. Among other positions, he's the former chief medical officer for Dell Healthcare and Life Sciences, where he was responsible for providing strategic insight to help them advance the support of healthcare organizations. So in today's conversation, we're going to cover two different subjects about digital healthcare in two different segments. In the first segment, I want to talk about how computer technology has impacted our lives from a healthcare point of view. And in the second portion of the show, we're going to get into some of the security and privacy issues that go along with using digital data in healthcare. So with that introduction, Dr. Nick, thank you so much for taking the time to join us tonight.
Alfred, it's great to be here. It's always a pleasure to catch up, and it's an exciting topic and one that, as you know, I've got plenty to say.
Absolutely. Not opposed to stirring the pot when the situation calls for it.
Always willing to stir the pot.
Excellent. Well, so let's talk about some of the positive sides of the news. Between more efficient processors, cheap memory, low energy devices, better power storage and batteries, wireless communications, the internet, big data, artificial intelligence, analytics. I mean, the list goes on and on. What are some of the impacts that this digital technology is having on healthcare from your perspective?
Well, I think it's interesting. You know, I graduated from medical school over 30 years ago. And as I look back at the education in those days, what we were taught and what we knew, even at that point, I think we were surpassing the brain's capacity to absorb, process, and ultimately use the appropriate information and knowledge at the point of care with the patient. I believe even in those days, we talked about the statistics of roughly 80 plus hours of reading time to keep up to date just in your specialty. So assuming that you focused on a single area of expertise, you needed to spend at least 80 hours to do the moves, adds, changes to your database, that is your brain in this instance, to be able to keep up to date. And that has only accelerated. I would say that, you know, stealing from Moore's Law, I think medical knowledge has been doubling for the last many years, every 18 months, easily. And our capacity to absorb that information. The one thing I know for your audience is you sure want whoever you're seeing to be providing you with the most up-to-date insights. And the reality of that is that the only way that we can actually deliver that is with technology. Because what is it that technology, computing, and all of those services that you describe is really good at? It's the capacity to access information, large amounts of information, process it and present it in the context of healthcare. So in general terms, it's about the use of all of that information. But then when you dig into this, I think the reality of our medical field is changing. So what we know about disease and the way that we treat disease is changing so quickly at this point. So the things that I learned in medical school, and I'll give your listeners a taste of some of the preposterous things that we accepted in those days, and we're only going back 30 years. When I was in medical school, we were sequencing the genome, and that was ultimately successful shortly after I graduated. And, you know, we had this massive set of data, four pairs of information, you know, sequenced in a DNA chain. 95% of that was deemed junk. Good grief. How could we possibly accept that something that had been refined over hundreds of thousands of years could possibly say, I'm going to have all this content, this data, but I'm not actually going to use it? Why did we think that? Because we didn't understand it. And of course, now we're understanding it.
And humans are very good at discarding what they don't understand.
Yeah, we do that all the time.
All the time.
And, you know, ultimately, as we sequenced it, so we had this, you know, the genome, and we've now accelerated that genome processing. And so one of the key areas of change that I see is data and the contribution of data. And underlying that is genomics. And it's not just genomics of you. Turns out that there's 10x of the genome in you just in what's called your biome. So the gut has all of these bacteria that we classified into about 22, 24 groups. But when you actually dig into that, you discover that those bacteria have much more unique signatures. We could never determine them because we didn't have the speed of processing and the ability to sequence it. We're now sequencing people's biome. We're looking at that biome, and it turns out that your biome signature is different depending on diseases. And we've seen now already instances of that data where we can influence the biome and reverse disease processes. So there was a paper published last year in Australia where they were showing biome impact on children for the treatment of asthma. What an extraordinary idea. So I'm not giving you drugs, I'm giving you bacteria. And we see a little bit of that with, you know, the context of changing people's biome. And of course, the, you know, the folks on listening in would think about this in a logical sense. If the biome has a signature that demonstrates a disease, if you change that signature, could you treat the disease? Diabetes is a perfect case in point. Now, to be clear, I'm not advocating that we can do that, and that may never happen. It may be a correlation as opposed to a causation. But
let's turn to diabetes, because, I mean, without getting too deep into it, we do see people who are certainly pre-diabetic who are able to get off their meds by lifestyle, diet, other kinds of changes. And even there's some evidence in cases of people who have full-blown diabetes who've been able to, you know, reverse a stage or two in terms of the condition of their disease. For the digital health part, one of the things that fascinates me is, you know, I've never quite understood the value of the finger prick. You know, 3, 4, 5 times a day, you find out what your blood sugar is, but you have no idea what it is the rest of the time. And that's why these continuous glucose monitors, the things that you stick on your belly, are so amazing, because they can provide round the clock measurement of your blood sugar, even when you're asleep. And now we're getting into this model of the hybrid closed loop systems with insulin pumps. What's your reaction about this?
Well, so there's a little bit of history there that I find fascinating. So first of all, the finger prick is a little bit invasive, and, you know, finding something that's transdermal. So that was all about the data and understanding the relationship between blood levels of glucose and being able to determine that through interstitial measurement, because those tap-on devices are not tapping into the blood flow, they're tapping into the interstitial fluid. So that was all about
the fluid that's between the cells in your skin.
Exactly, okay. As opposed to the blood flowing. And, you know, that was an algorithm that was essentially refined and, you know, created so that now we had a sensor that, you know, was effective to give you that continuous monitoring. I go back to the space program, you know, and I grew up through that. It inspired me to sort of do many of the things that I would do. If somebody knocked on the door right now, I'd tell you I'd leave this show to go for a flight to the moon. And, you know, so that's how much of a space nut. But they did telemedicine. And one of the things that I saw many, many years ago was the medical director who showed this piece of string. And he said, this is your medical record. And he took one small segment of it and he said, this is the measure of your blood pressure, in this case, glucose. And you measure it this one time. You're talking about two or three times a day, whatever the sequence number is. Well, even that, as you look at that full sequence, tells you very little. It's this one point in time. So now you've developed a continuous. So now we can see the reactions and responses to changes in diet, to stress, to sleep, all of those things that we really had no insight. And the best part of this story, the part that I love the most, is initially, you know, we developed this and, you know, the companies that developed it said, hey, we could do these things, but they wouldn't allow any sort of intervention on the part of the insulin therapy in the case of those being offered insulin or, you know, that biofeedback mechanism. How did they fix that? Well, of course, it was a hacker. It was a programmer who was a diabetic who was frustrated with the idea that suddenly there was all this data, but people weren't using it. Well, took that data and created essentially a device that, you know, you wouldn't be proud of unless you were a programmer and a hacker, because it was big and, you know, it was imperfect, and refined it and created this closed loop mechanism that essentially now provided the biofeedback. Now that's been commercialized because everybody goes, oh, well, that's obvious. We should do that. And they took it. And I hope, you know, somebody gets
two points about that.
Yes.
So one point is it's interesting to note that Europe through the CE program was ahead in terms of certifying this linkage between the glucose monitor and the insulin pump. The FDA has taken a lot longer to get there. And I'm not really that upset with the FDA for being slow. If they're being cautious and not just slow, I'm kind of okay with that. But the other thing is that open source closed loop system is blossoming. There's a huge movement on the internet where you can go. You can't create any of these devices to sell because then you're selling a medical device, but you can experiment on yourself all you want. And so there's this huge community. It gives you a shopping list, programs, tells you everything you need to know so you can put together your own and get this. And I'm not diabetic, but one of the things I understand to be a problem is when you're asleep, you can't stick your finger. And you can go way out of range in your sleep, and that's what leads to all the really dreadful complications. So I think that's kind of cool.
Just talk to any parent that has a diabetic child, and they'll tell you that they're, you know, recurring nightmare is the fact that they have to wake up their child on a routine basis to test their blood for that very reason. And here we've just solved that problem and created a solution that not only senses it and allows you to monitor it without that intervention of waking up and sticking somebody, but also better than that. And we know that from the consequences of the disease, that it's the uncontrolled changes in your glucose level that causes all these damaging effects, you know, the impact on your blood flow, the loss of limbs, the eyesight, all of those things are related to the glucose level in your blood. If you can control it in the same way. So what we're essentially doing is replicating the pancreas. It's an automated pancreas, or the islets of Langerhans to be specific. That's the cells that do this. And I remember, vividly remember this in medical school, you know, talking about the idea of, gosh, why could we not do the same thing as the islets of Langerhans? They're simply a programming choice. They respond to an input and, you know, react and produce a hormone. Why could you not do that with a computer program? It just seemed obvious to me. And I remember the response was, well, good Lord, it's this complex bio system and there's all these other, and sure, there may be other input factors. You just include them. That's the wonderful thing about the world that we live in today. It's just accelerating this process of innovation.
There's that history of not understanding things problem coming up again. So the thing that fascinates me is it's not just hardware that we're talking about. I mean, the FDA is now clearing algorithms. They're providing medical clearance for software. It's ethereal. It does, you can't touch it, and yet it's diagnosing and helping cure disease. One of the ones that I find absolutely fascinating. Are you familiar with a company called ResApp? They're from Australia, and they created an application for your smartphone. You make a recording of your kid cough, either your kid's cough when they have a cold, and it can accurately diagnose the cause of the cough. The cool thing is that in recent studies, they've just applied that same technology to sleep apnea. They're able to diagnose obstructive sleep apnea as accurately as you can in a sleep center with all the hookups and technology and all that stuff. And the difference is you don't have to go to a sleep center. You don't have to pay all that money. You can sleep in your own bed. You don't have cameras looking at you all night. You're not sleeping with wires attached to you and all that. I mean, it's just fascinating. I never saw this coming. I never saw software as a medical tool before. What's your reaction on this change? Because to me, this is one of the biggest sea changes in the whole business.
So I'd like to put it into the context of something that clinicians would know, but the general public wouldn't. The instant that somebody walks into my consulting room or my emergency room, as it was, I was already making an assessment. Before they said anything, I was looking. There was visual cues to me. And the process of defining what that was, I couldn't have explained it at the time, but my colleagues would understand this. We make an assessment, and as soon as you open your mouth and talk to me, I'm making an assessment on that. It's hard to sort of refine that. So in the context of that, you go, well, actually, that's not unreasonable to say we could listen and determine, but you have to take it to an extreme to really appreciate the potential of this. And, you know, you've described one example. I've seen research that demonstrates the capacity not just to diagnose a single condition, but to diagnose a wealth of conditions. Oh, and by the way, we can get any number of characteristics. You can listen to my voice and tell me everything about me, from my height to the room that all of these things that are you know, the finesse of our senses is not as highly attuned. And we've done a little bit of that with animals. We've seen, I think it was rats that were able to detect cancer in pathology samples highly accurately. So they have a very highly attuned sensory network. Same with dogs and their ability. I mean, did you know that there's a dog that will sense electronics?
No.
Actually, they have sniffer dogs to come and seek out things like USB sticks.
Wow.
How astounding is that? That they, you know, so this massive increase. And of course, we can replicate that with technology. So I absolutely see this as this huge opportunity for the inclusion of all of this knowledge and data, the incorporation of technology. The couple of points I want to make just rounding this out. This is not the replacement of the human being. It's not the replacement of the human interaction. That's what we desire in medicine. That's what we desire as clinicians. It's what we desire as patients. This is augmentation. The idea that
it's a better stethoscope.
Yes, it's augmenting our capacity. And, you know, perfect example is somebody elderly that's trying to listen in a stethoscope has already declined. So we augment the capacity of human beings to deliver better healthcare and do it more efficiently, more effectively. So this is not replacing the human interaction. It's supplementing it in a way that delivers better healthcare. That's really exciting to me.
And that's exactly what gets me excited as well. This is awesome. So folks, again, I'm talking tonight with Dr. Nick Vanterhayden. He's founder and CEO of incrementalhealthcare.com. And we're here talking about digital health and the impacts on our lives individually and as a society, and some of the gains that's that we're going to see coming out of them. And we'll be back in just a couple minutes, and we're going to get into some of the privacy and security concerns that come out of this whole digital healthcare world that we're building around us. Stay tuned.
Public service announcements of scheduled computer club meetings in the tri-state Northeast region. Princeton PC Users Group has a presentation on social media for small business, Thursday, July the 26th. Meeting time, 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on drones, sensors, and what are the applications for them. Thursday, July the 26th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society meets Tuesday, August the 7th, meeting time 7:30 p.m., at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey is off for July and August, but they will reconvene in September, Friday, September the 7th, meeting time 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartow Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. All these club meetings are free and open to the public, and we hope to see you there at one of these meetings. At these club meetings, there is a random access period in which you can ask questions. There's no such thing as a dumb computer question, so attend one of these if you have a problem and you haven't been able to get it solved. And now back to the interview with Alfred Poor and Dr. Nick.
Welcome back. This is Alfred Poor from Health Tech Insider, and I'm here tonight with Dr. Nick Vanderhaeden, who's CEO and founder of incrementalhealthcare.com. And we're talking tonight about the huge impact that computers and data have had on our personal lives from the healthcare perspective. It's amazing how it's lowering healthcare costs. It's improving outcomes for patients. We're dealing with diseases that we never thought we'd get a handle on. It's really been a remarkable revolution and transition. However, there's always the flip side to the coin. And so we'd like to spend this segment talking a little bit about the privacy issues, the security issues, what can we reasonably expect in terms of privacy, what is pragmatically are we going to have to give up in order to get some of the benefits that we want? Where is this leading us? So, Nick, to kick it off, how do you see the problem?
So I think one of the challenges that we have with all of this digital data, and in particular in healthcare, we have failed to incorporate privacy and security into our applications from the ground up. So the concept, and ultimately it came from a position of trust. One of the most trusted individuals in society was your physician. You shared incredibly intimate details, and not for one second would you ever expect or have the expectation that they would, break that trust, which is why I personally find any instance of that where clinicians do very, very troubling, because it damages it for everybody else. But that trust existed in a one-to-one relationship that was, paper-based. The security of that information was, for the most part, secured through securing those records. Once we digitized things, that was no longer a sufficient basis or foundation for the securing of that information. And unfortunately, in our rush to adopt this technology, I think we failed to account for the nefarious uses or potential misuses of that data and the outliers in society of individuals who see, misuse as an appropriate kind of behavior or activity.
So let me ask you my favorite go-to question on this. And I know I've asked you this before. So do you believe that it is possible to depersonalize a healthcare record to the point where it doesn't identify the individual?
My personal belief is that that's not possible in this day and age.
Yeah, I say the same thing. If you were to put somebody in with my zip code, 65 to 70, married, chronic atrial fib, I'm pretty sure you're going to find me. And, you know, it's not going to take too many other data points to
I believe exactly the number is about 10, and those aren't necessarily clinical data points.
Exactly.
And the majority of them are publicly available. I saw a really interesting presentation around this at DEF CON last year that essentially took this to the extreme and demonstrated and proved out the point of about 10 data points to be able to uniquely identify individuals and use the publicly available search information to essentially attribute or find individuals and connect them to their search history, which was supposed to be private.
Wow. That's scary. So but we have HIPAA, the Health Information Privacy Act, right? So we're covered, right?
Oh, yeah, of course we are. We've got a regulation, so that absolutely covers this. Well, of course, it's a regulation. There's, failure to comply with that. And, you know, what does HIPAA actually do? Well, in theory, it protects your information, or it governs how your information can be shared. I think there's an awful lot of misuse of that regulation in terms of prevention of hindered or limited as a result of the use of that. But it's just that, it's a regulation. It doesn't solve a problem. I think it was well-intentioned, but think about when it was created. I can't date it precisely, but it's pretty old. And in technical terms, anything that's more than about 2 or 3 years old is out of date.
Right. So what are the choices? Either surrender and play or don't play?
Well, I think the good news is I think there's some potential for new technologies, new innovation to create an environment that is more individually controlled. So I think what most individuals would say is I'd like to control my data and how it's used. Most people would say, I don't care who uses my data. When you're really sick or you're catastrophically sick, you'll give up anything for the support and help. But that's not an open-ended, revelation that says, hey, here's all my data, use it however you like. I think it's still with an expectation of appropriate use. So, I have some hope around technologies that can potentially allow us to secure and control our own data. But I'm still a little bit troubled by the specificity of the data that's out there. And I'll give you the one specific example that I have, which is genomics. How can you possibly anonymize a genomic data set if it contains your genes?
Right.
We use that in a court of law to prove that you did something. So
exactly. And recently we discovered that can have a long tail.
Yeah, I have to say I was deeply troubled by the impact of this. And, you know, I've seen lots of conversations online, the killer that was identified through genomic data. And, you know, they had samples of the DNA, but they had no matches and had no leads. And what they did was they used essentially the matching technology that exists in some of the familial sites. That allow you, and if you've ever given your data up to 23andMe or any of these other organizations, you'll get the emails from them that say, hey, we found the following close relatives, you know. And what that does is it creates a network of people, and they essentially loaded up what they had and used data that people had submitted to identify a relative. And, you know, that allowed them to focus in and identify this individual and catch a killer. Well, love the idea that they caught a killer, but I'm not sure that all the people whose data was used actually consented to that in an informed way. I'm sure right. they signed off on it on some form that was, you know, 22 pages long that they had to click before they could do anything. But did they know that this was the case? And I'm pretty sure most people, well, I don't know. I've seen people say, I'd happily give up all of my data to catch a killer.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there are very few of our listeners tonight who have read and studied every software terms of service and licensing agreement. So, you know, it makes a lot of sense that you're just going to click through and go for it.
Well, on a side note of that, there is actually a website that you can send the user policy, the AUP or whatever it's called in the instances, and it uses AI to essentially tease through these pages and say, here are the highlights, which I think is a fascinating concept of AI.
If you can send me that site,
I will.
I will see if we can't get it up on the website someplace. So that
I would tell you right now if I could recall it, but right. I will definitely send it.
I would trigger that. So what's your, in light of all this, what's your view of the All of Us study by the National Institutes of Health? Are you aware of that one?
No, help me.
Okay, so they're looking to enroll 1 million volunteer participants all you need to do is be 18 years or older, and you fill out some enrollment and consent forms, and then you can share your health history with them. And what they're going to do is they're going to make this entire database available to vetted, approved researchers. But rather than each researcher having to go out and find their own 100 or 200 or 500 subjects, they're going to have a ready-made pool of over 1 million subjects, which should be enough to get some of those orphan diseases to show up, that, you know, have some of those outlier kinds of things appear. I will confess right up front, I signed up immediately when they opened the enrollment. I think it's I have no illusions about my data being protected, but, you know, the people who are really moved to find out that they won't be able to find me if they really, really try. But I think for the greater good, I think there's more benefit coming out of this than risk for me as an individual.
So, I mean, what's not to like with, you know, overall good of society, contribution, hey, you could use it. And I think most people can sit comfortably with that. Unfortunately, the devil in this particular instance, as it often is in the detail of that. So you've contributed your data with the expectation that this is, you know, contributing to society. But what we've seen historically on a couple of fronts, number one, we've seen that it doesn't necessarily benefit society. It benefits a company that then capitalizes on your genome, that they discover something and becomes a very high cost drug, inappropriately so, or a high cost treatment of some description. And, you know, not to preclude companies from making money, they have to. But was that appropriate? And should you get a share of that if it was your data? There's no resolution.
One nice thing about the All of Us program is you can be very selective. It has great granularity in terms of what you wish to share and who you wish to share it with, which I think is it's not the whole solution, but it's an attempt to move in the right direction.
But once you've shared that, you know, what's the control? How do you track? How do you know? You know, we've got so many examples of instances of, you know, insulin's a great example. That was developed 90 plus years ago. And it's the price of that continues to rise in astronomical ways for a drug that is essentially generic, but, you know, with some twisting in terms of the way that it's sold and marketed. We can continue to keep a patent on it, which, you know, just seems unfair and unreasonable. So there's that aspect to it. And then the other one that troubles me about that, and, you know, and the regulations haven't quite caught up, they have in some instances, is, and my underlying tenet for this is, I'm fine with giving up my data as long as you don't use it against me.
Right. Or somebody else.
Or somebody else. The problem with that is that that's not covered. So it's covered from a medical standpoint. So if your genome shows that you have some disease, that doesn't then, you know, preclude you from a pre-existing condition issue and so forth. But unfortunately, it does impact your life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's troubling to me. I don't think we've, I think there are some unintended consequences in this that really give me huge pause. And I'm all about the contribution. That's how we advance science. Unfortunately, the way that things are configured, and we see it in the NHS, which is a different model, but the same challenges exist there.
NHS, National Health System, which is the United Kingdom Universal Healthcare Program.
Right.
So I want to switch gears here. In the top of the segment, we were talking about electronic health records and how we missed the opportunity to bake security in from the start, which is a bugaboo of mine. When the first IBM PC came out, we didn't have networks, let alone the internet. And so having somebody outside trying to get into your computer and get stuff out of it was science fiction. So I can give developers a pass for not baking security into the hardware level at that point. And then we had analog cell phones. And those transmissions were out in the clear. You could pick up a scanner and listen to people's conversations anywhere you wanted. So by the time digital phones came along, you know, you need to have, you should have had the security baked in, you know, right down to the lowest levels of the architecture. And I feel we also missed the same boat with no excuse for the Internet of Things. You know, we've had the nanny cams get hacked to be used as bots for denial of service attacks. We've had, you know, countless instances where routers and doorbells are just left wide open to the world to come in and do whatever they want. Fortunately, people take a lot more care with medical equipment. So we have a lot of medical equipment that can connect to the internet to share information. So We're pretty well protected there, right?
You are such a joker. Oh, good Lord. I wish that were the case. But as we have seen, thanks to Hollywood, we've seen the sort of terror of this. You know, I will take over control of your pacemaker. None of that was built in. It's not. It's all a retrofit. And I think the most troubling aspect of this is, unlike all of those other previous examples where the damage in this instance was you could lose some money. This was going to cost you $5, $500, $5 million, whatever it was. In the case of IoT devices and the medical profession, this doesn't cost money. This costs lives. That is absolutely and utterly unacceptable. And designing without the concept of securing that information and securing that communication
end to end,
end to end. And especially in the context, you know, as you say, I think you can forget, if you couldn't imagine it, it's hard to build for it and to secure against it. I think that's fair comment. But in this instance, this isn't imaginary. We know this, we've seen it. You see it on over and over again. Healthcare has the biggest target on its back, because it's such a rich data source. And the idea that we continue to ignore security and privacy of information and add this in only when it impacts it's plainly unacceptable at this point.
As we say, closing the barn door after the horse is gone.
Exactly. And that's currently the process. You know, the tragedy is it expands across everything. And, you know, some of the response to this, well, we don't need to connect the, let's say, insulin pump to the internet. Well, yeah, you do. We've just determined that actually there's some really good reasons to do so for positive impact, not just to share for that biofeedback mechanism that essentially creates this closed loop insulin treatment from the glucose measurement. But imagine if we shared that data in the context that you're sharing your genomic data for learning. Gosh, when Alfred's insulin pump triggers and we see a different reaction. Why is his data showing a different reaction? What can we learn from that? There's so many reasons that we want to share data, but we need to do so in the context of privacy and security that is appropriate to the individual and secures that individual from harm.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you talk about hospitals, healthcare having the target. Look at all the hospitals that were the targets of the ransomware. You know, I mean, they're wide open, fat and happy. And, you know, I know enough about healthcare institutions that they're struggling just to keep up. You know, they're too many mandates, not enough funding. They're struggling to make it all work. And so it's tough to put it all on them to make the change.
I think it boils down to security appears to be a cost as opposed to an investment.
Right.
And I think the mindset has to change that instead of thinking about securing this data as this cost that I wish I didn't have to spend anything I can avoid to do, we see it as an investment. It's an investment in the health. It's an investment in the safety. It's an investment in good quality care. And it's an investment in a relationship of trust. And healthcare is built on a relationship of trust. And all we're doing is damaging that relationship when every single breach brings, you know, new information to suggest that your data has been poorly looked after.
So from one enthusiast to another, let's bring out the scales of justice. Digital health, net positive, net loss. How do you feel?
I think it's very clearly a net positive. I mean, there is no question that the value of this information is an imperative. You know, we're going to look back in time at the way that we managed and treated patients with, you know, a quaint, almost nervous review that suggests that, well, it was okay if you consider the limitations, but the idea that we did those things is going to seem almost archaic, yeah. You know, in the same way that we look back at, you know, the printing press now, and, you know, the idea that that was this controlled mechanism, it's just not, and it's accelerating. And the beauty of digital health is it will accelerate our understanding, both through the knowledge, but also through the data. We're going to find correlation initially, and will lead to causation. And the concept of randomized controlled studies will, I think, disappear as we accumulate this information and are able to do these real-time tests of real-time data and real-time patients. And, you know, you highlighted those individual patients, those orphan drugs, the onesies, twosies, no longer are onesies, twosies. There's right. more of them. And even if it is only the singles, there's reason to be able to go after that because we've got access to that information and continuous data.
Cool. So there's reason for hope.
I'm extraordinarily hopeful. I mean, I love the time that we're in, the speed of change and the opportunity that this exists to accelerate our learning, to deliver better care, and importantly, to do it economically. I mean, one of the things that we've failed to do is to assess the value or the contribution of each of these treatments in the context of what happens and how much we pay for them. But as we learn more and we free that data, we allow more people to assess that and determine whether that's appropriate for them. It may be appropriate for somebody else, but making that determination much more individual, I think, is going to turn us into a better healthcare system, better healthcare delivery.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Nick, my good friend and colleague, Nick Vanderhaeden. He's CEO and founder of incrementalhealthcare.com. I encourage you to go check out his site. He's got podcasts, he's got articles, he's got fascinating people. And if you're at all interested in digital health, this is a man who's sat in a lot of different chairs in this whole ecosystem. And has, I believe, unique insights and perspective that are extremely valuable. So, Nick, I can't thank you enough for being so generous with your time this evening.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Always a delight to catch up and always a delight to talk about these things.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Once again, This is Alfred Poor from healthtechinsider.com, and I thank you for spending your evening with us, and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thank you, Alfred. What's going to hold all this together is the Internet of Things, the necessary protocol, the communications, and the security that we expect it to have. 5G mobile networks and wireless systems are the next phase in global telecommunication standards. Wireless connectivity has expanded far beyond smartphones and wireless LAN routers to new and previously unimaginable markets and applications. Technology has been evolving from person-to-person communications towards device-to-device connectivity throughout the connected homes, machine-to-machine, industrial, and automotive markets. Many are calling this the Internet of Things, or IoT. There will be new technological applications bringing profound advancements in deep learning, artificial intelligence, and ambient awareness. The way we do business and interact with each other today will be virtually unrecognizable, perhaps in the next 5 to 10 years. The technological changes are disruptive. A simple explanation of what is the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is becoming an increasingly growing topic of conversation both in the workplace and marketplace. It has the potential to impact how we live, but also how we work. But what exactly is the Internet of Things, and what impact is it going to have on you, if any at all? Let's start with some basics. Broadband internet has become more widely available as the cost of connecting is decreasing and more devices are being created with Wi-Fi capabilities and sensors are built into them. Technology costs are going down and smartphone penetration is, skyrocketing. All these things are creating a perfect storm for the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things, simply put, is the concept of basically connecting any device with an on and off switch to the internet and or to each other. This includes everything from cell phones, coffee makers, washing machines, different appliances, headphones, lamps, wearable devices, and just about anything you can think of that has an on and off switch. This also applies to components of machines, for example, a jet engine of an airplane or the drill of an oil rig. If it has an on-off switch, then, chances are it can be part of the Internet of Things. The analyst firm Gartner Group says that by 2020, there will be over 20 billion connected devices. However, most other experts estimate that the number could be as high as 100 billion devices. The Internet of Things is a giant network of connected things as well as people. The relationship between people to people, people to things, and things to things. How will this impact you? Anything that can be connected will be connected, but why would you want so many connected devices talking to each other? There are many examples of what this might look like and what the potential value might be. Say, for example, you are on your way to a meeting and your car have access to your calendar and already knows the best route to take. If the traffic is heavy, your car might send a text to the other party notifying them that you will be late. On a broader scale, the Internet of Things can be applied to things like transportation networks, smart cities, which can help us reduce waste and improve overall efficiency. Talk of wireless networks ahead of the upcoming Mobile World Congress is leading many into believing that 5G networks could feed all of our internet device needs. But now is the time for industry leaders from around the world to develop and agree on standards for 5G networks, which are projected to switch on as early as 2019. 5G is the first network designed to be scalable, versatile, and energy smart for the hyper-connected Internet of Everything world. These next-generation networks and standards will need to solve a more complex challenge of combining communications and computing together to intelligence is at your fingertips and available in machines that make up the Internet of Things. Last year, Cisco, Intel, and Verizon, in a joint wireless network research project, revealed a novel set of neuroscience-based algorithms that adapt video quality to the demands of the human eye, hinting that future wireless networks would have built-in human intelligence. The 2G networks were designed for voice. 3G for voice and data, and 4G for broadband internet experience. With 5G, we'll see computing capabilities getting fused with communications everywhere, so trillions of things like wearable devices don't have to worry about computing power because network can do any processing needed. These 5G networks will be faster, but also a lot smarter. Devices will need to become smarter too, as they will act as networking nodes rather than just terminals. With 5G, computing power and information will feel like they're following you around, and wearables, smartphones, tablets, and other devices with sensors that are location and context aware will work together with apps and services that you use. Transition to 5G wireless technology will stimulate revenue growth for cell tower REITs, Crown Castle, and American Tower. New markets for wireless carriers will drive more leases for cell tower REITs as 5G opens the way for wireless to compete with fixed broadband services. All four of the major U.S. wireless carriers today, which includes AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint, are investing now to test 5G systems in the 28 GHz and 39 GHz bands authorized by the FCC in 2016. Assignment of these high spectrum bands tell us a lot, as 5G signals won't travel so far as 4G signals due to the use of the much higher spectrum. That means delivery of 5G service will require wireless carriers to invest in more cell towers as well as in small cell and fiber networks to distribute 5G signals to targeted areas. Qualcomm announced its first 5G modem chip, Snapdragon X50, which was successful in a recent test in San Diego in October of 2017. Although the specifications for 5G have not yet been firmly set by the Third Generation Partnership Project, whose members are a collaboration of telecom makers in Japan, United States, China, Europe, India, and Korea, Release 15 came out in early 2017 with rules now accepted for standard 5G silicon manufacturing. First chip designers such as Qualcomm's Snapdragon X50 are now produced at low volumes, with handset vendors such as Samsung and Apple expecting to ship their first 5G products for use by commercial accounts by the end of 2018. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI FM 99.5 in New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.